This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte's murder count rises yet again. It now stands at 49. Clayton Wilcox takes the reins as superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools and in his first week on the job makes changes. Election season approaches and news is being made in races from the one for Charlotte mayor to city council and the school board. We dive in and it's a wrap in Raleigh. The legislature ends their session, so what did they accomplish? Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nick Oxner back from WBTV News. Hello.
Hello.
Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call and a contributor to WCCP News Rising and NBC BLK. Hello, hello, hello.
Hello.
And Ann Doss Helms is education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, because there's some education news that we should talk about.
There is, even in the summer.
Yes, indeed. You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook, where you can also see this broadcast on Facebook Live. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks and use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. Well, the number of Charlotte murders has grown in 2 weeks by two, I believe. It now stands at 48. The latest involves conflicting stories. WSOC-TV reported earlier this week that a man who was an innocent bystander was shot, the result of an argument between others. Meanwhile, WCCB-TV reported earlier this week that the deceased, Tommy Maddox, was involved in that argument with a woman when a group approached them and shot him in the head. Police are telling yet a different story, I think, on Monday. So do we have the story straight about what actually happened?
I don't think so yet. I mean, quite honestly, I don't think so. And it's part of the it's indicative of a situation that you find yourself in as a witness or as a police officer going into a scene like a murder, especially one where there's some kind of altercation taking place. You know, one of the things that we're always taught when we watch shows like Law and Order is, you know, eyewitnesses. They are the bedrock of how we prove everything. And the reality is, when you study courts and you study court cases, that eyewitness testimony can be the least reliable. So this is, unfortunately, the nature of the beast here, trying to figure out who is innocent, who is involved, you know, what their role may or may not have been is always going to be tricky. And really, the only thing you know is that someone died.
What was the what story is the police? What did they reveal? What did they say happened? Do we know? Off the top of our heads?
Not off the top of my head.
Well, we are on track here in Charlotte to reach 95 homicides this year. That's a third more than the 67 we saw in the city last year by the end of the year. Most of the victims in all of these shootings are between 21 and 35, the youngest being 3 months old. And Judy Williams of Mothers of Murdered Offspring reacted this way to the latest shooting.
I refuse to accept that this is the trend for Charlotte, and this is the way it's going to keep going. I refuse to accept that.
So we'll be holding a public conversation about this on Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church. Judy Williams and CMPD Chief Kerr Putney will be among our guests, and there are more details at WFAE.org about how you can register to attend. We'll talk more about this on Tuesday night. Meanwhile, and that will air, I believe, Tuesday night at 7 o'clock straight up. There we go. Meanwhile, on March 8th, a CMPD officer shot and killed a Ukrainian immigrant, and the Mecklenburg County District Attorney has now said that the officer was justified in the use of deadly force. Tom, remind us what happened.
This is also a very troubling case. There's a 911 call that is placed to the CMPD. It's a sister calling in about her brother, who she believed was having, you know, basically a breakdown, is I think the way she said it in the 911 call, and that she was looking for her brother was looking for her boyfriend's gun. And she apparently or reportedly told police there was a part missing from that gun, so it would not fire. Police arrive on the scene, and they see the man who would eventually die carrying a long gun, a rifle. And they don't know whether or not he has found that missing piece to make it fireable. So he's brandishing.
So dispatch did not tell the officers that.
I don't know whether they told the officers or not. All I know is the way that it's being portrayed is that the officers did not know whether or not the gun was functional. Mm-hmm. They had to assume that it
and
was.
And that would be a big risk to
sure.
take.
Absolutely.
To trust the word that that gun sure. being pointed at your partner
yes.
is not going to work.
That's a really great point.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, it also points to the fact that so many of these calls are for mental health issues. And people call the police. And a lot of the police said, we aren't trained for this. But this is the, you know, they're going to have to be trained for the situations that they are going to encounter. And I fear that sometimes folks will stop calling for help if they feel it's going to end in this way, which is also a problem. But, so it's a very difficult situation.
But according to the reports that I've read about this, when the police officer knocked on the door and the door was opened, he discovered a man pointing a rifle.
And yes, and that's what happened. And so here's an interesting situation, right, I think, where you have a situation where cops are confronted by a man with a gun, right? Mm-hmm, and so under the law and under logic training. And common sense and training, an officer is completely justified to shoot somebody who's pointing a gun at them. And that's what you would expect an officer to be able to do, right? Because, mm-hmm. God forbid, I don't want a gun pointed at me. And you don't know what that man's going to do with that gun. That being said, I think Mary raises a very interesting point in how the – and we don't know. I'm not casting judgment, but I think it's worth asking. Did the officers do the right thing to de-escalate a situation where you know you're responding to a mental health call? And for the – I've been here just over 2 years, and for just over 2 years I've been following in the news stories of police officers responding to mental health calls in Charlotte and killing the people that they're being called out to respond to. And so when you're responding to someone with a mental health issue and in a mental health crisis at that moment, there's a different way that you would approach them. There's a different way that you de-escalate a situation, and you can't use traditional policing tactics of just confronting someone and trying to issue it head on all the time. And we know that Charlotte offers specialized training to deal with mental health people to some officers in CMPD. What's never been clear to me, and my colleague Sarah Blake Morgan asked this question yesterday as she covered this story, whether or not the officers that responded to this scene had received that special mental health training. Mm-hmm. So we don't know if CMPD is actually sending these officers who have the proper training to go deal with these calls, and the department has never expanded on that.
Anne.
There's a column that Tanya Jameson wrote for The Observer this week that's been getting a lot of readership around the country, and it goes beyond sort of the specifics to this broader pattern. And she said, and you may recall, Tanya, it was a black woman who was held at gunpoint by an off-duty police officer who thought she was stealing a car that, in fact, she had just bought. And she talks about the fact that citizens are essentially expected to de-escalate trained police officers, that she was not shot because she reacted very calmly and did everything right. And in fact, the police praised her for that. But the standard that we see nationwide in incident after incident is if the citizen does anything wrong that causes any fear in these police officers, then the shooting is justified. And, you know, regardless of the specifics of this one, that's a pattern that is of great concern.
Is this separate from or part of the militarization of the police that we've been witnessing across the country?
I clearly see this personally as separate from. You know, the militarization of police is an absolute fair question in terms of you know, tactics in certain situations. But this is not the kind of incident where you're going to see a police officer show up in an armored vehicle or a former Humvee. This is not the kind of incident where you're going to see them showing up, you know, carrying an assault weapon, in theory. The broader point is exactly what both Mary and Anne talked about, which is you have a certain group of individuals, police officers, who are in theory supposed to be able to handle these situations, since they're the ones who do risk their lives and go headlong into these troubled situations. But with that does come a responsibility. It's a question of tactics.
So the district attorney in this particular case with the Ukrainian individual who was suffering mental problems and who had a gun that would not work, was still shot by police because they didn't know the gun would not work, was that he ruled it justifiable homicide. Mm-hmm. And the tape, the judge has said that the body cam recordings will be released to the public with some alterations to protect the identity of the wife involved. So that's forthcoming, correct?
That's what we're told.
And it's worth noting that police couldn't just make the decision to release that themselves. They have to go get permission from a judge because our legislature has ruled that not even police can decide when to release their videos and when not.
Right.
To.
That's a recently passed law, but I think January 1st it went into effect.
But we do seem to be getting more videos since it was passed, so that's a good thing.
All right. On July 1st, I saved the best for last because this is probably the last thing we'll get to in the whole program today. Clayton Wilcox is on the job. On July 1st, Clayton Wilcox, who is the new superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, after months of observation, took over from retiring Ann Clark as CMS superintendent. At his swearing-in ceremony, he said that he stands on the shoulders of giants. Who was he referring to?
Well, he was referring to Ann Clark in particular. He thanked her for her leadership and the fact that she had helped him make this transition. There was sort of this weird 3 to 4 month period where she was very actively leading the district and making big decisions and sometimes even talking about what we're going to do in the coming year. And he was kind of sitting on the sidelines. And, you know, he said he was okay with that he, you know, the transition was awkward in some ways, but now he was sworn in. This happened on the Monday, July 3rd, that sort of dead zone between a weekend and a holiday. So you had a special meeting in the morning. They swore him in. Mary McCrae literally said, "You have 90 seconds. So he gave his little 90-second spiel. And then they went into closed session to talk about personnel matters. And then they came back out and said, "We're voting on contracts for," and listed off a number of names and all in favor. And they all raised their hands and adjourned. And he talked then to the press for about 15 minutes. And we asked him some questions about his new staff, but we hadn't seen any of the details. So it turned out there was a little more to that story.
There's been a lot of turnover in recent years of Charlotte-Mecklenburg school superintendents. So is this the normal course of action where they swear a person in, they go into closed session, he or she says, "Here's who I want," they approve or disapprove, and we move on? Is that how it works?
You know, I don't have that strong a memory of the actual swearing in.
I don't recall this happening before.
Well, I think it happens, and certainly the changing of the top lieutenants is a part of a transition.
Sure.
That is to be expected.
Right.
And changing of titles, you know, there's always this – that's why it's so hard. People always want to say, does Superintendent A have more top administrators than Superintendent B? And it gets hard to tell because they change the titles. But what was a little unusual was that – they didn't say any of this in a public session. They literally just said the names. And so I immediately requested, and I think a couple other reporters there did too, you know, "I want to see the contracts." And they said, "Well, we can't provide those until they're all signed and dated," which in the past they have just given you the draft without the signature. So I said, "Well, I want to see the names, the positions, the salaries, the length of the terms." So that was what we got just on Wednesday.
I gave you that. Have you had a chance to meet and talk with Clayton Wilcox at any great length?
Yeah, yet? We've sat down a couple times and talked.
And your impressions are?
He is an interesting guy. It's kind of hard to get – he's so different from the politician-in-chief folks that we've had, and I think I've said that before, that he's very low-key, he's very unassuming, he seems to be approachable. When I finally got the contracts or the information about these people, I said, "I need to talk to you about this," and he immediately called me on the phone and we talked. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think he seems to be a good-hearted guy. He is notorious for not being able to remember details and names. He literally stumbled on the name of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools during his swearing-in, but he laughed about it afterwards. So,
I like him already.
Yeah. All of us of a certain age can identify with that spacing out on details.
So how would you say he compares in style, at least? I'm going to talk about the appointments in a second, but we're heading toward a break. How would you say that he compares in style to Ann Clark, who was pretty well-liked in the system because she spent her entire career in the system? And
I think,
like the back of her hand.
I think in some ways they are a bit similar in that you talk about the other people hired through searches, national searches. Peter Gorman, Heath Morrison had been through the Broad Institute, had been through this training. They had a very polished package. It's very much kind of, "Look at me, I'm the leader." And that was not necessarily out of ego. That's viewed as part of the job. You know, you become the face of the schools. And Clayton's kind of been like, you know, "I'm here. I'll let the board take the spotlight."
But we are working with CMS to schedule an hour with Clayton Wilcox as soon as possible. We'll let you know when that happens. And when we come back, we'll talk about some of the appointments that he has made and the money they're making at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar, located at Burkdale Village in Lake Norman, offering wines from around the world, live local music, and craft beer on tap. Relax, uncork, unwind. The Corkscrew, details at thescrewcrew.com. And the Cabarrus Arts Council presenting the On Stage at the Davis shows, along with local acts for 2017 and 2018. Season tickets and details at cabarrusartscouncil.org. On the eve of our public conversation on Charlotte's rising homicide rate, WFAE's Sarah D'Elia shares what she sees as a fuller picture. She's chronicled the city's 49 homicides by documenting the stories of those killed and by going on patrol with CMPD. We'll do that Monday morning on this program. And then our block-by-block series continues at Camp North End, slated to bring offices, restaurants, and entertainment to an area that has languished for years. That's all Monday on this program at 9.
I'm Ray Suarez. Coming up on the next On Point, President Trump at the G20, North Korea on notice, state budget battles. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues with On Point at 10, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE, plus Facebook Live. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Tom Bullock, reporter for WFAE News, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call and WCCB, and Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We just happened to be talking about Clayton Wilcox, who took over officially on July 1st, but was sworn in on July 3rd as head of CMS. What do we know about his new appointments, and how many new appointments at the cabinet level, at least, did he make on Monday?
Well, this actually started in April, okay. And some of the big salaries and big changes happened then, which you will recall was in the thick of student assignment, and we were all running in 10 directions, so it didn't get much attention, and I will take credit or blame for that as much as anybody. So this was then kind of the next batch, and what we're seeing when you get a chance to really look at the numbers and the names and the salaries is that he has brought in some people from his former district in Washington County. That's Hagerstown, Maryland. Mm-hmm, It's a much smaller district, about 22,000 people. The school board, after Heath Morrison, after that relationship fell apart, there were people saying, you know, he didn't bring anybody with him from Reno, and maybe that was a sign that he was not a great manager to work for, which turned out to be one of the allegations. So I think there was actually some implicit or even explicit pressure for him to bring some of his staff with him. So he did. He brought Laura Francisco, who was his chief of staff there and is his chief of staff now. And she was brought in at $175,000, and that's about $40,000 more than what the previous chief of staff had been making. So we knew that, and we knew that the previous chief of staff, Ernest Winston, had been moved over to an ombudsman community engagement position that is new. And he also went up to the $175,000 level. And he is now supervising the person who had been in charge of that at about $130,000. She's still there. You kind of saw the same type of arrangement with the technology office, which I have to admit, I don't understand technology. I know it's really vital. And what he's saying is that Derek Root, the guy that he brought in from, again, Hagerstown, Maryland, is really top-notch on the technological details. That Valerie Truesdale, who was brought in from a more educational position, is really good at the using of the technology, but maybe not as strong on the...
That's who was in the position?
She was in the position. And again, they sort of split it into two highly paid positions. Derek Root was brought in at $183,500, which is almost $18,000 more than Valerie Truesdale was making. She's still there in a more limited role that's focused more on the use of the technology in classrooms.
So when when you and I were sitting here on this program talking about the student assignment plan, you made some suggestions about how they could have better explained the student assignment plan visually on their website. With this new IT whiz, do you think they'll be able to do things like that more readily?
I don't know how much that's a question of what he would – and again, this is not my strength. I'm the person who could also use the technology and not know how it works.
Right.
But the communications job has not been filled. And what he said is that, yes, there are some big increases here, but we're going to offset that with some slightly smaller salaries, and that the chief communications officer will now be an executive director. That person has not been hired. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably going to be the most important piece in how things are communicated.
Tom.
I just want to go back to the salaries here.
Oh, I'm getting back to that.
Yeah, no. Well, I hate to steal your thunder on that. Go right ahead.
Well, as you mentioned, the chief of staff will make $175,000. That's $40,000 more than the previous chief of staff. And he's raised the previous chief of staff to that same amount of money. We're going to talk about where all this money's coming from in a second. But Wilcox said that Laura Francisco, the chief of staff he will have here, who came with him from Hagerstown, is crucial to his success, he said, and that he needed to entice her to move here. Now, on the face of it, you would think, well, Hagerstown, Charlotte, surely you don't need to be enticed. But maybe you do. Maybe you like life in Hagerstown.
And probably housing costs a little more here than it would in Hagerstown. Because that was what I was thinking, is if we brought in somebody from L.A., you would say, well, yes, the salaries are higher, so we have to bump ours up. But on the other hand, you can get a whole lot more house here than you could for the same salary in L.A. So the reverse may be in play.
But he also hired, and maybe this was to entice her here, hired her husband. You initially reported that Wilcox hired the husband of his chief of staff to an $85,000 a year job as a community engagement manager. Later, it was reported that he created the job of culinary manager for his chief of staff's husband. So which is it? What job does he have at $85,000?
It is culinary manager, and it is a newly created and unusual job, which people are either going to love or hate, depending on how you feel about this kind of thing. He will be making sure that cafeterias deal with the needs of students with special dietary issues. He'll be helping to cultivate partnerships with people who can help schools do community gardens.
Is this what he did in his
old life? Yes, he was with Food Services in Hagerstown, and he is a former chef. And, you know, I don't know what the motivation was, whether it was we need to bring in someone to get her to come, or whether it was just that he saw this guy who can do these great things and said, hey, CMS can use
this. So WSOC-TV asked Wilcox if the culinary manager job was created specifically for Francisco, and here's what he told them.
Well, we created the job. We didn't create it for Jody, but Jody did fill it because he had the skill set that went there.
So was his job posted? Were there other people who were interviewed? Did you take applications from other people?
No, we really did not in this case. We created a position kind of from clean cloth, and because I knew the person, because the board had asked me to bring some people to kind of stir some things up, I did it in that process.
But you can see why people would say that it looks like it was created because no one else was able to apply.
Well, absolutely. I absolutely can see why that is.
So that's the first time I've ever heard his voice. He was asked to bring people to stir things up, he said.
Yeah, and I haven't heard him.
Board?
I haven't heard him phrase it quite that way, but as I mentioned, you know, they wanted to see him bring some people. You never want somebody who's just going to say, you know, we're just going to chug along exactly as we are. And he's been striking a balance of saying this is not a broken, dysfunctional district. This is not one where we need to tear it up and start over. But we can do some things better.
But I don't think it's a good look to pretty much – he just admitted after saying he didn't do this. He just admitted that he made a job for the husband of his chief of staff.
Yep.
After saying he didn't do that. And that's a bad look.
Well, and here's the thing. Let's just step back for a second here because – There's two things I want to point out getting back to the salaries. And again, Anne, your reporting on this has been fantastic. We just laid out at least
$300,000.
I was going to say before we got to all of the differences, at least just in the positions we're talking about right now, $165,000 just in these three positions. That's additional salary. This comes at an interesting time. I've been to Hagerstown. It is, what, one-seventh the size, in terms of a school district, one-seventh the size of CMS. Should they receive a pay bump from what they were getting in Hagerstown? Sure. But we're talking about a pay bump from the positions that were currently being held here in CMS. So it's not just a pay bump over what they were making.
Right.
It's a pay bump over what everybody else is making. And here's the other thing that's important to note. The budget – the state budget, which Governor Cooper vetoed and the General Assembly quickly, you know, overrode that veto, includes this little tidbit, which is central staff for school districts are going to see their budgets cut by 10% in terms of the amount of money that the state is giving them, 10%. So when you have all these additional costs and you've got a 10% decrease in the amount of funding you're getting from the state, the books aren't going to balance unless you start cutting the position or the county bumps up what they contribute.
And Clayton Wilcox is getting more than Ann Clark got for this job. How many salaries are now approaching $200,000, $300,000 at the executive level in CMS?
His. Well, 200,000 there. Sheila Shirley is getting very close. I think the chief technology officer, George Battle, the general counsel, I believe is also very close to 200 or getting into that range.
You wanted to jump
in. I just wanted to say, to take a little broader look, we're talking about Charlotte as a city that has a problem with social mobility and these kinds of issues. And when you say you have a job that wasn't posted, I think these kinds of things come into play to make some people in the city think that, you know what, it's really harder and harder to break into things.
There is nobody here at this table, I don't think, who's an HR expert, but don't you have to post public jobs? Don't you have to post them? They didn't post this job.
I'm not an HR expert, but generally speaking, certainly for a public position in the state of North Carolina, you're required to advertise the job.
And I'm not sure that's true at the top level, but it is an interesting question because this is not a cabinet-level position. This is a manager job that would not have ever gone for a public vote had it not been the chief of staff's husband.
The Observer's lead editorial today is headlined, "Who Says There's No Money in Education?" and it goes on to say, "Want a 30% raise for doing the same or comparable job as you're doing now? Hurry on over to Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, where new superintendent Clayton Wilcox and the school board are handing them out left and right. Oh, unless you're a teacher or someone else down the chain. Then you're stuck." Teachers have been clamoring for raises, and they've been getting them here and there over the last several years. But when we talk about workforce or affordable housing, that's who we're talking about.
Teachers and assistants and bus drivers and cafeteria workers.
So what are the optics of all these major – $40,000 is a big raise.
And that's just one position.
Right.
This will become like the soccer stadium. You know, the thing that any time they say we can't afford this, it's going to be like, oh, but you had money for these raises. And I think
where is this money coming from?
I am assuming that it's coming from county dollars. I have not seen an
– But the county always underfunds the schools. The school goes in with the budget. The county cuts it and gives them the money that they
want. Yeah, I don't think it's fair to say that they underfund it. There's a negotiating process that goes in between.
In the school's opinion.
In the school's opinion, sure.
They underfund the schools because they don't get what they ask for. So if the county is funding this, what are we losing?
Well, that's a good question, and I have to plead a little bit here that I was on vacation for 2 weeks when the state budget landed. So there's always this calculation that happens. The bigger the staff raises from the state, the more county money it takes to match their share of it. So actually, the less county money is left. So good news for teachers can be bad news for other flexibility. So we should say that there is going to be vastly more state and county money going into raises for the rank and file because there are so many of them. But if you are that rank and file seeing a modest salary grow modestly.
Why is there such a great disparity between – I know it's a big organization, but he's not running the Bank of America. So why is there such a big discrepancy between what the head people, the administration is making versus the rank and file teachers who are actually doing the work? They're in the room with the kids doing the job of education.
Well, I think it's a great question, but I don't think that's in any way specific to CMS.
No, it's not.
I mean, don't get to see our boss's salary, but I suspect if we did, we'd say, why are they making so much more than we are? And I think if you compared these jobs in CMS to corporate jobs with similar responsibilities, I suspect the corporate folks are making more. So it's the American way.
It is a cultural thing, too. I mean, that's something that we as Americans have grown to accept, that the people at the top make far more than the people who are physically in the middle of it.
And that gap has grown and grown and grown.
And I want to go back to my earlier point. I realize it sounds esoteric, but I think it answers your question, Mike, which is we don't fully know yet. Again, the central office of CMS will have its budget cut from the state by 10%. That is fact. That is law. So with all this extra money, they really have – the county has two choices. They either pump more money in to make up the difference or positions have to be cut. Mm-hmm. There is no other way they can do it because I don't believe they can run a deficit.
Well, and here's another – getting back to the Ann said that because of the state teacher raises, the county has to put more money into that. So we should unpack that for a second because the county, like most counties across the state, has a teacher supplement, a local supplement for their teachers that is a percentage of the teacher's salary. So a 3% – I don't know what Mecklenburg County supplement is, but you know, somewhere – probably 3 or 5%. So if they're getting a raise, that 3 or 5% number goes up. So as the county is going to give probably millions more in teacher supplements for the teachers, we're going to also, I guess, have to fund the raise for every executive in the C-suite at CMS.
And the big ask from CMS this year was for more social workers, counselors, psychologists in schools. And everybody said, yes, this is important. This is essential for the kids. It's essential for supporting the teachers. And they have already said that since they didn't get quite as much county money as they wanted, they're maybe going to have to scale back on that. So you wonder, as all this plays out, do we get at least a perception that we got more high-level administrators and fewer
And where are we in that? Has he finished staffing his executive suite yet?
No, we've still got a couple of those positions, human resources and communications, he's still doing a search for. And there are all these people, and the names always change, but the learning communities, the regional offices, basically the people who oversee clusters of schools. And those have kind of proliferated over the years. And he said he's already eliminated one of those. He merged. We had, the Barry and the West Mech were separate, and they've been merged.
When we went from Peter Gorman, I'm going to forget the transition here, but Peter Gorman to
Hugh Hadabaugh and then Heath Morrison.
Morrison, did the salaries go up for the people that they brought in as substantially as they've gone up in this case?
Again, it's always been hard to tell because people move. I don't remember jumps quite this big, but it did. I think when Peter Gorman came in, that salaries went up quite a bit, if I'm remembering that far back.
I just want to go back to one phrase that Ann used there, the big ask, because the big ask is actually a second thing which we haven't talked about here yet. You know, Clayton Wilcox is coming in as captain of CMS when the district itself is not necessarily sailing on, shall we say, smooth waters, right? You've got student assignment already controversial, but you also have looming in November a nearly $1 billion bond ask. So what I'm curious is with this, if these optics continue, if people start noticing and keep noticing these great salary bumps, will they be willing to say yes, build the schools? And they are separate issues.
The bonds are separate issues.
They absolutely are.
Bricks and mortar.
Sure. And it's financed in a completely different way. Mm-hmm. I understand that. But I think to most people, it comes down to an issue of, do I trust CMS to spend this money? Okay. And if you're questioning nepotism, if you're questioning salaries, it may be that people don't.
Yeah, the last time bonds were defeated in 2005, there was no doubt about the need. And in fact, some of the biggest defeat came from the North, which they were mad that they weren't getting more. So it was very much a, we're upset with CMS at that time, rather than a, we don't believe these are rational needs.
You can't ask people to compartmentalize these things in their mind when they go in the voting booth, as much as you try to explain it, and as much as they may know on the ground from their kids that these things are needed. So I do
think emotions also play.
Of course, as Nick was saying, the optics of this, you have to say, there are a lot of people who are thinking, wow, I wish I had it. You know, apply for that culinary manager.
Well, I just want to say that I'll be happy to accept a $40,000 raise.
Well, and you asked about Clayton's style and personality, and I think that one thing this tells us is that either he doesn't have a very good eye and ear for how these things will play, or he does, and he just is willing to do it anyway. And I don't know which of those it is yet.
He was also asked about the student assignment plan that his predecessor, Ann Clark, hammered out over the last year of her tenure. If parents were hoping that it would go away, it doesn't sound like that it will, because here's what he said.
What I would say to people is to watch us go forward, because we're going to continue to move forward the board's plan, but we're going to really try to operationalize that in ways that I think make sense over time.
We only have 30 seconds. What does that mean?
It means what he's been saying all along, that they approved these policies and we're going to make them work.
Okay. When we come back, there's a lot of local politics flying around because filing for elections starts in about 2 hours and 20 minutes from right now for city council and school board and Charlotte mayor. We'll talk about that and other things with our roundtable of reporters on the local news roundup when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and America's biopharmaceutical companies. Every day, 140,000 researchers across the country, including thousands in North Carolina, search for tomorrow's breakthrough cures. More information at goboldly.com. And Tyndall Subaru Gastonia featuring the new Outback with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com and on Facebook at Tyndall Subaru. Protests in Germany as President Trump arrives for the G20 summit. North Korea is put on notice over its first ever test firing of a missile that could reach the United States, and budget battles play out in several state capitals. Those stories and more as the news roundup continues during On Point. And then a reminder that this coming Tuesday night, July 11th, we're having a public conversation about Charlotte's growing homicide count, which will include a conversation with Chief Kerr Putney. That'll be at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church. Information at WFAE.org.
Mornings can be a race. Get up, get ready, and get out the door.
It's about political gerrymandering, which really is when state legislatures draw districts.
For those who have zero connection to the United States, the travel ban can now apply to them.
A lot of people do not come to our home school of Sedgefield.
Spend 20 minutes with NPR News to catch up on what happened while you were asleep and look ahead at the stories that will shape the day. Stand with the facts. Listen every day.
Stay in touch with 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Mary C. Curtis is here, columnist for Roll Call, WCCB, and other publications and media outlets. Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV News, at my old job. And Tom Bullock, reporter for WFAE News.
I'm half right. The media personality that you are, Mike.
shucks.
Let's switch gears here. Election season is about to launch in about 2 hours and 18 minutes.
Well, who's counting?
Yeah,
right. Unless you're listening to this on delay, in which case it's
it started.
You're too late to apply.
Filing begins today for several races, including that for Charlotte Mayor. That race seems to have already begun. The incumbent Democrat Jennifer Roberts is in, running against in the primary against Mayor Pro Tem Vi Lyles and State Senator Joel Ford. Two others jumped in, as we said a couple weeks ago. Maybe they're in, maybe they're out, who knows. But they came to the conclusion that they should run during a debate or just prior to a debate. Are they still in, or do we know whether they're in or not?
That's the joyous thing about the media circus that's about to happen, just the circus in general, that's about to happen at the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections. It's one thing to sit at a forum and say, okay, I'm going to run for mayor. It's another thing to plunk down the $200+ and fill out the paperwork to make sure you actually are going to run for mayor.
So we have to see.
Which starts at noon today. And you're very fond of saying that.
Well, TV and radio and newspaper will be there covering this.
I'll be there.
Does everybody generally file at noon or do they wait? Because it's a two-week period.
That's why there's really not much news today because it is a two-week period, so you don't know who's not running. You know, if Vi Lyles doesn't file today, that doesn't mean that she's decided to drop out of the race.
I'm pretty sure we know Vi Lyles is running.
I think all that talk about one of us is going to drop out meant they agreed that the other one should drop out. So. You know, as Jim Morrill noted, if Pat McCrory walks in and files for mayor, we've got some really great breaking news. But he does need a job, but I don't think that's going to happen.
So some political pundits are saying that crime in Charlotte will be the key issue in the mayor's race. Should it be, given what control the mayor actually has over crime and how it is prosecuted or prevented?
Here's a basic question. I love falling back on this. The economy is almost always the top issue for the presidential campaign.
Mm-hmm.
The president of the United States has very little to almost no ability to move the economic needle. They can do so in small parts, but never in the mass ways that they always promise, regardless of party. Mary brought this up earlier. It's that emotional aspect when you get in the voting booth. Candidates will try to connect with people based on what is at top of mind. And right now, crime in Charlotte is part of it. I don't know if it will be the biggest issue because I do think that there is a good chunk of people who see this as a problem but not a personal problem for them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it will be a top issue and it should be.
If you remember 2 years ago, Jennifer Roberts ran heavily on education issues, a thing over which the mayor of Charlotte has virtually no control.
Right.
But she talked about it nonetheless. And I think that crime's going to be a central topic, but I think it's going to be a central topic in a way as it relates back to other things because we've seen people like Joel Ford and Vi Lyles already talking about if people had jobs, they wouldn't be in the streets fighting each other. If people had affordable housing, this could all – you know. And so I think it's going to be a central point from which we talk about other things.
Okay. Well,
and at 11:30, the show's actually going to start a little early because you've got a group of self-described conservative candidates for city council and school board who are going to be there at 11:30 before they file to talk about this press release says the need for focus on public safety and education during the 2017 election.
The oxymoronic thing about American elections is that this is going to be an off-year election, and voter turnout for off-year elections is notoriously low.
Mm-hmm.
And politics is local. All politics is local. It should be the opposite way because the people who are really going to affect your life are the city council and the county commission and the mayor, not the president of the United States.
I think, though, that being that politics, it's on people's minds, and we did have a very contentious national elections, I think it woke up more people to the idea of politics. And you see in these local races, I think the Observer had a piece that some younger people are running for these council seats because they want to get younger people involved.
Well,
and I think there's an overarching narrative of, in Charlotte, control. We like a very orderly city. And the thing with crime, whether it affects you or not, or the building all over the place, everywhere you go, it's a new building, or new schools, new superintendents, there's a sense a little bit that Charlotte is losing some of that overall control that it was so proud of. And so I think that will be one of those emotional issues. Who can connect? Who can come and say, you know, I am going to be a leader and get a hold of this?
So a CNN poll, exit poll, last fall indicated that voters under 40 made up 36% of the electorate, and Catawba College political scientist and frequent host of this program, Michael Bitzer, found that voters 40 or younger accounted for just 30% of North Carolina voters last year. But as you mentioned, there are younger millennial candidates running for city council. Will they be able to turn out a greater percentage of younger voters?
It's possible, but here's the trick with those numbers. People tend to react when it comes to mobilizing bases to the prior election. So just because that 2016 election was so contentious, we may see more voters from both sides be motivated to vote. I'm not about to predict that we're going to have record turnout in an off-year municipal election. However, I can tell you that I think this is going to be it's a great time to own a TV station, frankly, because I think with the incredible level
printing
of attention
money
that you're going to get from mayoral candidates. We know of at least two dark money groups, one Republican, one Democrat, that are going to say they're going to spend heavily to influence the Charlotte mayor's race. You've got four open city council seats, no incumbents. You've got lots of opportunity for ads and people trying to get their name out there. So you're going to get – everybody should be prepared for the blizzard of TV ads and mailers that are coming.
The turnout would have to be better than it's been in the past mayoral races. It's been pretty dismal.
Let's let the TV guide
talk. We're just happy. No, Tom raises an interesting point, though, about the level of money that we're going to see in this election. Already we've seen the filings from, three of the four candidates for mayor alone, and there's some speculation that Jennifer Roberts, she hasn't released hers yet, but will raise about $250,000 through the end of June. So, I mean, we're already talking there's nearly $1 million just in actual campaign money, not dark money.
In three candidates.
Yeah, that's been raised. And so that means it's going to be a very expensive, ugly.
And there are a lot of people running at the moment. We can assume that there are at least three Democrats running for mayor and one Republican running for mayor. We can make that assumption until they file or they don't file. There may be more. There may be less. It's also a crowded field for city council. There are at least four open seats, some at the district level, some at the at-large level. At least five Democrats have expressed interest in running in District 2, where Al Austin, the incumbent, is not running. As many as six may run in District 5, where John Autry has left to join the North Carolina House and where his replacement is running at large. Do we know who some of these people are who want to vie for these seats, or is it too early to tell?
I mean, some of the names are well known. I don't want to list off
names
just because I think it's an unfair advantage. But the reality is what people should take away from this is simple. There are a lot of people who want to come in. So the dynamic on the city council, the dynamic potentially for mayor, the dynamic for school board, all of these are about to change at a contentious time in American politics.
And it's really up to the voters, too. All these folks who say, oh, I don't care about politics and whoever's in charge, it doesn't matter. Well, okay, there are going to be a lot of new people coming in. So a lot is going to be on the
And
election.
As the last six months has shown us, clearly it does matter. Back to education for a moment, the school board elections. As we just talked about, there's a lot of contention going on.
Yeah.
If you read the editorial page of the Charlotte Observer about salaries being paid to incoming people with the new superintendent, and that comes after that. It comes after the student assignment plan was released. It comes in prior to the school bonds being on the horizon in the November election. And six of nine member seats on the school board are up for grabs. Are these all district and not at-large?
They are all district. The at-large comes 2 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And district incumbents tend to get reelected when they're on the ballot. When I talked about 2005, when everybody was so mad that they didn't pass bonds, they still reelected incumbents. But three of the incumbents have said they're not running. So that right there tells you three
and
new members.
And some old-timers, Tom Tate in District 4, Eric Davis in District 5, Paul Bailey in District 6. Eric Davis used to be chairman of the school board. Why aren't they running? Just had enough?
Well, Tom has done this for 12 years, so I think that's pretty reasonable. Eric, I think, has done it for 8 and said that he is also a member of the State Board of Education, and he said he wants to focus on that. Paul Bailey, I think, is going to file for a municipal office. He kind of hinted at that. Yeah. He may have decided that's a lot more fun than being on the school board. This is always such a frustration to me, is that people care so much about schools and pay so little attention to the school board race, because it's also nonpartisan, which means if your idea of, you know, you love the D's and hate the R's or vice versa, you can't just check that name. Although I think, again, with this, you know, school board taking part in this conservative press conference, there's going to be some pretty strong efforts to brand people in terms of their party.
I would think having a root canal is more fun than being.
Well, yeah, I think we underestimate just the level of crap that school board members, city council. I mean, but really, it's a lot of headache for virtually no pay and really very little thanks, even if, you know, agree or disagree with the job they're doing.
And the school board actually gets paid a lot less than county commissioners and city councilmen.
Really?
Whatever you may think about the.
Or arguably a much bigger headache.
Yeah.
Okay, if the legislature has ended their session temporarily, because they come back in August, but they've ended their session, and at least one reporter says it ended as it began, with the Republican-controlled body locked in disagreement with our Democratic Governor Roy Cooper. Cooper fought efforts by the legislature to dilute his powers. He vetoed some bills. So what's the score?
Well, I think it's fair to say the General Assembly won. I mean, if you just look at the actual – if this was a sport and you just looked at actually who, you know, all of those vetoes either were overridden or are, you know, up to be considered in early August when they come back from special session. Now, that's if you look at it just strictly in terms of who won in terms of what got passed. In terms of who won the fight, I don't know. I mean, you know, there are some things like the huge dust up about the Senate deciding that, you know, they're going to enforce a clause in the Constitution. It was a clause in the Constitution that said that they had the right to advise and consent on cabinet appointees. I don't mind saying that, especially since judges agreed. It, you know, looked like it was going to be this huge battle over who gets to be, you know, Governor Cooper's top aides to his cabinet secretaries. And nothing happened. Nothing. I mean, everybody breezed through their hearings and everybody was approved. Nothing. I think personally, I think, you know, Cooper seemed to target what bills he was going to veto so he didn't look just like a veto factory. The General Assembly, you know, just quickly overrode all of them. So I don't, you know, the overall score.
But the governors also sued in the courts to have some things overturned. For instance, the reduction of appeals court judges from 15 to 12, which was designed specifically to prevent Roy Cooper from appointing judges when judges had retired.
And now what we see is that in the budget, the General Assembly has cut the money that the governor has to file lawsuits and pay for outside legal counsel.
Yep.
I think this session is a reminder that North Carolina has amongst the weakest governors in the country, even more weak when he has when the opposite party has supermajorities in both chambers, because he can veto all he wants, but it's
but you know, one thing in terms of the final win on this, it's actually going to be determined when the next election is, whenever that is, because what is it? I think the supermajority, you know, Republicans have supermajority in both the North Carolina House and Senate. I believe the supermajority in the House is 2 seats.
Yeah.
So if the Democrats can take 2 more seats,
might be 3.
It may be 3. But anyway, it's a literal handful of seats. That changes the entire dynamic.
Senate leader Phil Berger said the state is excelling under the GOP's vision. Noting a drop in the unemployment rate, lower taxes, higher high school graduation rate. I'm not sure what the legislature had to do with a higher graduation rate, but it was revealed this week that a lot of middle-class jobs in the state's urban areas have simply disappeared since 2000. So what kinds of jobs are responsible for the drop in unemployment that they're taking credit for?
You know, I don't know the specifics on that. I don't know if Nick knows the specifics on that, but there is a national trend that a lot of you're seeing a lot of growth at high-end jobs, high-salary jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And you're seeing you're seeing a lot of growth at low-end jobs. The jobs that are disappearing in the middle are jobs where you see automation growing, you see outsourcing.
Governor Cooper just announced yesterday in Wake County 2,000 new jobs coming to Raleigh at $75,000 each. I mean, those are the kinds of jobs that are coming here.
So let's talk very quickly about the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity, headed by Vice President Pence and with the assistance of the Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach. They've asked all 50 states to come up with and provide voter information. North Carolina has said no to most of it. South Carolina's legislature has said no, but now a Republican in South Carolina is going to buy that information, which you can legally do, and supply it to the commission.
Yes, the South Carolina Republican Party chair, Drew McKissick, after the Republican governor had balked because so much of the information, really, it's not legal to provide. They've asked for like the last four digits of your Social Security number, as well as your voting history, your party, your name, your affiliations. And it's really interesting because a lot of conservatives talk about small government is best. But now we have this federal panel, which, let's face it, President Trump has kind of initiated because he's still saying that he didn't win the popular vote because there were 3 to 5 million people illegal who were voting.
And there are those who say that's what this is. This is a mystical hunt for things that don't exist.
Well, a big clue is that he appointed as co-chair Kris Kobach out of Kansas, who's running for governor there.
But he's a leader in this effort.
Yes, who's been a leader in these, purging voter rolls, looking for vote fraud. At the same time, you have the real election hacking, which our intelligence agencies has said was Russia, and they're really not looking into that. And you have the problem that not enough people in this country vote. So they're looking for this, and it's been fascinating how parties, Republicans and Democrats in the states see this as an affront because it's proven there's really not voter fraud, and they've been pushing back, and that's been an interesting surprise.
So where does North Carolina stand in all of this?
They're going to give partial information. They're not going to include Social Security numbers. Most of it you can find on the website, but what's interesting to me is the fact that you do have a lot of Republican states who see this as an issue of states' rights. I mean, my favorite one is the Secretary of State for Mississippi who said, jump in the Gulf.
Yeah, he said you have a good launching pad right here.
And that's all the time we have. But we don't even get to talk about the premiere of perhaps early alcohol sales on Sunday, which is inevitable.
Cheers.
Order that mimosa at brunch.
We'll save that. Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call. Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Nick Ochsner from WBTV. Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.